Accept if you wish. You'll be safe with him.
The clan chief seemed to have forgotten his earlier assertion that Ajthwelden Rak Anwin would not harm a guest. Thank you, I might at that. As Eragon left the hall, he pulled Oryk aside and asked, How serious is this feud, really? I need to know the truth. Oryk answered with obvious reluctance,
In the past it was not uncommon for blood feuds to endure for generations. Entire families were driven extinct because of them. It was rash of Ajthwelden Rak Anwin to invoke the old ways. Such a thing has not been done since the last of the clan wars. Until they rescind their oath, you must guard against their treachery, whether it be for a year or a century. I'm sorry that your friendship with Hrothgar has brought this upon you, Eragon. But you are not alone. Dorgrimst Injitum stands with you in this.
Once outside, Eragon hurried to Saphira, who had spent the night coiled in the courtyard. Do you mind if I visit Selbadil?
Go, if you must, but take Zarok.
He followed her advice, also tucking Nasuada's scroll into his tunic. When Eragon approached the gates to the hall's enclosure, five dwarves pushed the rough-hewn timbers aside, then closed in around him, hands on their axes and swords as they inspected the street. The guards remained as Eragon retraced yesterday's path to the barred entrance of Tarnag's foremost tier. Eragon shivered. The city seemed unnaturally empty. Doors were closed, windows were shuttered, and the few pedestrians in evidence averted their faces and turned down alleys to avoid walking past him. They're scared to be seen near me, he realized. Perhaps because they know Ajthwelden Rak Anwin will retaliate against anyone who helps me. Eager to escape the open street, Eragon raised his hand to knock. But before he could, one door grated outward, and a black-robed dwarf beckoned from within. Tightening his sword belt, Eragon entered, leaving his guards outside. His first impression was of colour. A burning green sword splayed around the pillared mass of Selbadil, like a mantle dropped over the symmetrical hill that upheld the temple. Ivy strangled the building's ancient walls in foot after foot of hairy ropes, dew still glittering on the pointed leaves. And curving above all but the mountains was the great white cupola ribbed with chiselled gold. His next impression was of smell. Flowers and incense mixed their perfumes into an aroma so ethereal, Eragon felt as if he could live on the scent alone. Last was sound, for despite clumps of priests strolling along mosaic pathways and spacious grounds, the only noise Eragon could discern was the soft thump of a rook flying overhead. The dwarf beckoned again and strode down the main avenue towards Selbadil. As they passed under its eaves, Eragon could only marvel at the wealth and craftsmanship displayed around him. The walls were spotted with gems of every colour and cut, though all flawless, and red gold had been hammered into the veins lacing the stone ceilings, walls and floors. Pearls and silver provided accents. Occasionally, they passed a screen partition carved entirely of jade. The temple was devoid of cloth decorations. In their absence, the dwarves had carved a profusion of statues, many depicting monsters and deities locked in epic battles. After climbing several floors, they passed through a copper door waxy with verdigris and embossed with intricate patterned knots into a bare room floored with wood. Armour hung thickly on the walls, along with racks of staff swords identical to the one Angela had fought with in Fardendur. Ganel was there, sparring with three younger dwarves. The clan chief's robe was rucked up over his thighs so he could move freely, his face a fierce scowl as the wood shaft spun in his hands, unsharpened blades darting like riled hornets. Two dwarves lunged at Ganel, only to be stymied in a clatter of wood and metal as he spun past them, wrapping their knees and heads and sending them to the floor. Eragon grinned as he watched Ganel disarm his last opponent in a brilliant flurry of blows. At last the clan chief noticed Eragon and dismissed the other dwarves. As Ganel set his weapon on a rack, Eragon said, "Are all Quan so proficient with the blade? It seems an odd skill for priests." Ganel faced him.
"We must be able to defend ourselves, no? Many enemies stalk this land."
Aragorn nodded. "Those are unique swords. I've never seen their like, except for one an herbalist used in the Battle of Farthendur." The dwarf sucked in his breath, then let it hiss out between his teeth.
"Angela."
His expression soured.
"She won her staff from a priest in a game of riddles. It was a nasty trick, as we are the only ones allowed to use Húthvirn. She and Arya."
He shrugged and went to a small table where he filled two mugs with ale. Handing one to Aragorn, he said,
"I invited you here today at Hrothgar's request. He told me that if you accepted his offer to become Injitum, I was to acquaint you with dwarf traditions."
Aragorn sipped the ale and kept silent, eyeing how Ganel's thick brow caught the light, shadows dripping down his cheeks from the bony ridge. The clan chief continued,
"Never before has an outsider been taught our secret beliefs, nor may you speak of them to human or elf. Yet without this knowledge, you cannot uphold what it means to be Nurla. You are in Jitum now, our blood, our flesh, our honour. You understand?"
"I do."
"Come."
Keeping his ale in hand, Ganel took Aragorn from the sparring room and conveyed him through five grand corridors, stopping in the archway to a dim chamber, hazy with incense. Facing them, the squat outline of a statue swelled ponderously from floor to ceiling, a faint light cast across the brooding dwarf face hacked with uncharacteristic crudeness from brown granite.
"Who is he?"
asked Aragorn, intimidated.
"Gunterra, king of the gods. He is a warrior and a scholar, though fickle in his moods, so we burn offerings to assure his affection at the solstices, before sowing, and at deaths and births."
Ganel twisted his hand in a strange gesture and bowed to the statue.
"It is to him we pray before battles, for he moulded this land from the bones of a giant and gives the world its order. All realms are Gunterra's."
Then Ganel instructed Aragorn how to properly venerate the god, explaining the signs and words that were used for homage. He elucidated the meaning of the incense, how it symbolized life and happiness, and spent long minutes recounting legends about Gunterra, how the god was born fully formed to a she-wolf at the dawn of stars, how he had battled monsters and giants to win a place for his kin in Alagasia, and how he had taken Kilf, the goddess of rivers and the sea, as his mate. Next, they went to Kilf's statue, which was carved with exquisite delicacy out of pale blue stone. Her hair flew back in liquid ripples, rolling down her neck and framing merry amethyst eyes. In her hands, she cupped a water lily and a chunk of porous red rock that Aragorn did not recognize. "What is that?" he asked, pointing.
"Coral taken from deep within the sea that borders the Beors."
"Coral?" Ganel took a draught of ale, then said,
"Our divers found it while searching for pearls. It seems that in brine certain stones grow like plants."
Aragorn stared with wonder. He had never thought of pebbles or boulders as alive, yet here was proof that all they needed was water and salt to flourish. It finally explained how rocks had continued to appear in their fields in Palancar Valley, even after the soil had been combed clean each spring. They grew! They proceeded to Urur, master of the air and heavens, and his brother Morgothal, god of fire. At the carmine statue of Morgothal, the priest told how the brothers loved each other so much neither could exist independently. Thus Morgothal's burning palace in the sky during the day, and the sparks from his forge that appeared overhead every night. And also thus, how Urur constantly fed his sibling so he would not die. Only two more gods were left after that, Sindri, mother of the earth, and Helsvarg. Helsvarg's statue was different from the rest. The nude god was bowed in half over a dwarf-sized lump of grey flint, caressing it with the tip of his forefinger. The muscles of his back bunched and knotted with inhuman strain, yet his expression was incredibly tender, as if a newborn child lay before him. Ganel's voice dropped to a low rasp.
Gunterra may be king of the gods, but it is Helsvog who holds our hearts. It was he who felt that the land should be peopled after the giants were vanquished. The other gods disagreed, but Helsvog ignored them, and in secret formed the first dwarf from the roots of a mountain. When his deed was discovered, jealousy swept the gods, and Gunterra created elves to control Alagesia for himself.
Then Sindri brought forth humans from the soil, and Urur and Morgothal combined their knowledge and released dragons into the land.
Only Kilf restrained herself. So the first races entered this world.
Aragorn absorbed Ganel's words, accepting the clan chief's sincerity, but unable to quell a simple question.
How does he know?
Aragorn sensed that it would be an awkward query, however, and merely nodded as he listened.
This, said Ganel, finishing the last of his ale, leads to our most important rite, which I know Auric has discussed with you. All dwarves must be buried in stone, else our spirits will never join Helsvog in his hall. We are not of earth, air, or fire, but of stone. And as in Jitum, it is your responsibility to assure a proper resting place for any dwarf who may die in your company. If you fail, in the absence of injury or enemies, Hrothgar will exile you, and no dwarf will acknowledge your presence until after your death.
He straightened his shoulders, staring hard at Aragorn.
You have much more to learn, yet uphold the customs I outline today, and you will do well.
I won't forget, said Aragorn.
Satisfied, Ganel led him away from the statues and up a winding staircase. As they climbed, the clan chief dipped a hand into his robe and withdrew a simple necklace, a chain threaded through the pommel of a miniature silver hammer. He gave it to Aragorn.
This is another favour Hrothgar asked of me, Ganel explained. He worries that Galbatorix may have gleaned an image of you from the minds of Durza, the Razak, or any number of soldiers who saw you throughout the Empire.
Why should I fear that?
Because then Galbatorix could scry you. Perhaps he already has.
A shiver of apprehension wormed down Aragorn's side like an icy snake.
I should have thought of that, he berated himself.
The necklace will prevent anyone from scrying you or your dragon as long as you wear it. I placed the spell myself, so it should hold before even the strongest mind. But be forewarned. When activated, the necklace will draw upon your strength until you either take it off or the danger has passed.
What if I'm asleep? Could the necklace consume all my energy before I was aware of it?
Nay, it will wake you.
Aragorn rolled the hammer between his fingers. It was difficult to avert another's spells, least of all Galbatorix's.
If Ganel is so accomplished, what other enchantments might be hidden in his gift?
He noticed that a line of runes cut along the hammer's haft. They spelled Astim Hefthin. The stares ended as he asked, Why do dwarves write with the same runes as humans? For the first time since they met, Ganel laughed, his voice booming through the temple as his large shoulders shook.
It is the other way around. Humans write with our runes. When your ancestors landed in Alagesia, they were as illiterate as rabbits. However, they soon adopted our alphabet and matched it to this language. Some of your words even come from us, like father, which was originally Farthen.
So then Farthen Dur means...
Aragorn slipped the necklace over his head and tucked it under his tunic.
Our father.
Stopping at a door, Ganel ushered Aragorn through to a curved gallery located directly below the cupola.
The passageway banded Selbadil, providing a view through the open archways of the mountains behind Tarnag, as well as the terraced city far below. Aragorn barely glanced at the landscape, for the gallery's inner wall was covered with a single continuous painting. a gigantic narrative band that began with the depiction of the dwarves' creation under Helsvarg's hand. The figures and objects stood in relief from the surface, giving the panorama a feeling of hyperrealism with its saturated, glowing colours and minute detail. Captivated, Aragorn asked, "How was this made?"
"Each scene is carved out of small plates of marble, which are fired with enamel, then fitted into a single piece."
"Wouldn't it be easier to use regular paint?"
"It would," said Ganel, "but not if we wanted it to endure centuries, millennia, without change. Enamel never fades or loses its brilliancy, unlike oil paint. This first section was carved only a decade after the discovery of Fardandur, well before elves set foot on Alagazia."
The priest took Aragorn by the arm and guided him along the tableau. Each step carried them through uncounted years of history. Aragorn saw how the dwarves were once nomads on a seemingly endless plain, until the land grew so hot and desolate they were forced to migrate south to the Beor Mountains. "That was how the Haderach Desert was formed," he realized, amazed. As they proceeded down the mural, heading toward the back of Selbadil, Aragorn witnessed everything from the domestication of Feldunost to the carving of Isidar Mithrim, the first meeting between dwarves and elves, and the coronation of each new dwarf king. Dragons frequently appeared, burning and slaughtering. Aragorn had difficulty restraining comment during those sections. His steps slowed as the painting shifted to the event he had hoped to find: the war between elves and dragons. Here the dwarves had devoted a vast amount of space to the destruction wreaked upon Alagazia by the two races. Aragorn shuddered with horror at the sight of elves and dragons killing each other. The battles continued for yards, each image more bloody than the last, until the darkness lifted and a young elf was shown kneeling on the edge of a cliff, holding a white dragon egg. "Is that?" whispered Aragorn.
"Aye, it's Aragorn, the first rider. It's a good likeness, too, as he agreed to sit for our artisans."
Drawn forward by his fascination, Aragorn studied the face of his namesake. "I always imagined him older." The elf had angled eyes that peered down a hooked nose and narrow chin, giving him a fierce appearance. It was an alien face, completely different from his own, and yet the set of his shoulders, high and tense, reminded Aragorn of how he had felt upon finding Saphira's egg. "We're not so different, you and I," he thought, touching the cool enamel. "And once my ears match yours, we shall truly be brothers through time. I wonder, would you approve of my actions?" He knew they had made at least one identical choice. They had both kept the egg. He heard a door open and close, and turned to see Arya approaching from the far end of the gallery. She scanned the wall with the same blank expression Aragorn had seen her use when confronting the Council of Elders. Whatever her specific emotions, he sensed that she found the situation distasteful. Arya inclined her head. "Grimstporith."
"Arya."
"You have been educating Aragorn in your mythology?" Ganel smiled flatly.
"One should always understand the faith of the society that one belongs to."
"Yet comprehension does not imply belief." She fingered the pillar of an archway. "Nor does it mean that those who purvey such beliefs do so for more than material gain."
"You would deny the sacrifices my clan makes to bring comfort to our brethren?"
"I deny nothing. Only ask what good might be accomplished if your wealth were spread among the needy, the starving, the homeless, or even to buy supplies for the Varden. Instead, you've piled it into a monument to your own wishful thinking."
"Enough!"
The dwarf clenched his fists, his face mottled.
"Without us, the crops would wither in drought, rivers and lakes would flood. Our flocks would give birth to one-eyed beasts, the very heavens would shatter under the gods' rage."
Arya smiled.
"Only our prayers and service prevent that from happening. If not for Helsvog, where..."
Aragorn soon lost track of the argument. He did not understand Arya's vague criticisms of Durgrimst Quan, but he gathered from Ganel's responses that in some indirect way she had implied that the dwarf gods did not exist, questioned the mental capacity of every dwarf who entered a temple, and pointed out what she took to be flaws in their reasoning, all in a pleasant and polite voice. After a few minutes, Arya raised her hand, stopping Ganel, and said, "That is the difference between us, Grimesboroth. You devote yourself to that which you believe to be true but cannot prove. There we must agree to disagree." She turned to Aragorn then. "Vajswaldan Rakanwin has inflamed Tarnag citizens against you. Unding believes, as I do, that it would be best for you to remain behind his walls until we leave." Aragorn hesitated. He wanted to see more of Selbadil, but if there was to be trouble, then his place was by Saphira's side. He bowed to Ganel and begged to be excused.
"You need not apologize, Shadeslayer," said the clan chief.
He glared at Arya.
"Do what you must, and may the blessings of Gunterra be upon you."
Together, Aragorn and Arya departed the temple, and surrounded by a dozen warriors, trotted through the city. As they did, Aragorn heard shouts from an angry mob on a lower tier. A stone skipped over a nearby roof. The motion drew his eye to a dark plume of smoke rising from the city's edge. Once in the hall, Aragorn hurried to his room. There he slipped on his mail hauberk, strapped the greaves to his shins and the braces to his forearms, jammed the leather cap, coif, and then helm over his head, and grabbed his shield. Scooping up his pack and saddlebags, he ran back to the courtyard, where he sat against Saphira's right foreleg.
"Tarnag is like an overturned anthill," she observed.
"Let's hope we don't get bitten."
Arya joined them before long, as did a group of 50 heavily armed dwarves who settled in the middle of the courtyard. The dwarves waited impassively, talking in low grunts as they eyed the barred gate and the mountain that rose up behind them.
"They fear," said Arya, seating herself by Aragorn, "that the crowds may prevent us from reaching the rafts. Saphira can always fly us out."
"Snowfire as well? And Undin's guards?"
"No, if we are stopped, we shall have to wait until the dwarves' outrage subsides."
She studied the darkening sky.
"It's unfortunate that you managed to offend so many dwarves, but perhaps inevitable. The clans have ever been contentious. What pleases one infuriates another."
He fingered the edge of his mail.
"I wish now I hadn't accepted Hrothgar's offer." "Ah, yes. As with Nasuada, I think you made the only viable choice. You are not to blame. The fault, if any, lies with Hrothgar for making the offer in the first place. He must have been well aware of the repercussions."
Silence reigned for several minutes. A half-dozen dwarves marched around the courtyard, stretching their legs. Finally, Aragorn asked,
"Do you have any family in Dueldenvarden?"
It was a long time before Arya answered,
"None that I'm close to."
Why is that?" She hesitated again.
"They disliked my choice to become the Queen's envoy and ambassador. It seemed inappropriate. When I ignored their objections and still had the Yahweh tattooed on my shoulder, which indicates that I have devoted myself to the greater good of our race, as is the case with your ring from Brom, my family refused to see me again."
"But that was over 70 years ago," he protested. Arya looked away, concealing her face behind a veil of hair. Aragorn tried to imagine what it must have been like for her, ostracized from her family and sent to live among two completely different races.
"No wonder she's so withdrawn," he realized. "Are there any other elves outside of Dueldenvarden?"
Still keeping her face covered, she said, "Three of us were sent forth from Ellesmere. Faolin and Glenwing always travelled with me when we transported Saphira's egg between Dueldenvarden and Trondheim. Only I survived Durza's ambush."
"What were they like?"
"Proud warriors. Glenwing loved speaking to birds with his mind. He would stand in the forest, surrounded by a flock of songbirds, and listen to their music for hours. Afterward, he might sing us the prettiest melodies."
"And Faolin?" This time Arya refused to answer, though her hands tightened on her bow. Undaunted, Aragorn cast around for another subject. "Why do you dislike Ganel so much?" She faced him suddenly and touched his cheek with soft fingers. Aragorn flinched with surprise. "That," she said, "is a discussion for another time." Then she stood and calmly relocated herself across the courtyard. Confused, Aragorn stared at her back. "I don't understand," he said, leaning against Saphira's belly. She snorted, amused, then curled her neck and tail around him and promptly fell asleep. As the valley darkened, Aragorn struggled to stay alert. He pulled out Ganel's necklace and examined it several times with magic, but found only the priest's guarding spell. Giving up, he replaced the necklace under his tunic, pulled his shield over him, and settled down to wait through the night. At the first hint of light in the sky overhead, though the valley itself was still in shadow, and would remain so until almost midday, Aragorn roused Saphira. The dwarves were already up, busy muffling their weapons so they could creep through Tarnag with utter secrecy. Undin even had Aragorn tie rags around Saphira's claws and Snowfire's hooves. When all was ready, Undin and his warriors assembled a large block around Aragorn, Saphira, and Arya. The gates were carefully opened. No sound came from the oiled hinges, and they set out for the lake. Tarnag seemed deserted, the vacant streets lined with houses where its inhabitants lay oblivious and dreaming. The few dwarves they encountered gazed at them silently, then padded away like ghosts in the twilight. At the gate to each tier, a guard waved them through without comment. They soon left the buildings and found themselves crossing the barren fields at Tarnag's base. Beyond those, they reached the stone quay that edged the still grey water. Waiting for them were two wide rafts tied alongside a pier. Three dwarves squatted on the first raft, four on the second. They stood as Undin came into view. Aragorn helped the dwarves hobble and blindfold Snowfire, then coaxed the reluctant horse onto the second raft, where he was forced to his knees and tied down. Meanwhile, Saphira slipped off the pier into the lake, only her head remained above the surface as she paddled through the water. Undin grasped Aragorn's arm.
"Here is where we part. You have my best men. They will protect you until you reach Duwelden Varden."
Aragorn tried to thank him, but Undin shook his head.
"No, it is not a matter for gratitude. It is my duty. I am only shamed that your stay was darkened by the hatred of Ashthwelden Rakanwyn."
Aragorn bowed, then boarded the first raft with Oric and Arya. The mooring ropes were unknotted, and the dwarves pushed away from shore with long poles. As dawn approached, the two rafts drifted toward the mouth of the Ajragni, Saphira swimming between them.
Diamonds in the Night. "The Empire has violated my home," so thought Roran as he listened to the anguished moans of the men injured during the previous night's battle with the Razak and soldiers. Roran shuddered with fear and rage until his whole body was consumed with feverish chills that left his cheeks burning and his breath short. And he was sad, so very sad, as if the Razak's deeds had destroyed the innocence of his childhood haunts. Leaving the healer, Gertrude, tending to the wounded, Roran continued toward Horst's house, noting the makeshift barriers that filled the gaps between buildings, the boards, the barrels, the piles of rocks, and the splintered frames of the two wagons destroyed by the Razak's explosives. It all seemed pitifully fragile. The few people who moved through Carverhal were glassy-eyed with shock, grief, and exhaustion. Roran was tired, too, more than he could ever remember being. He had not slept since the night before last, and his arms and back ached from the fighting. He entered Horst's house and saw Elaine standing by the open doorway to the dining room, listening to the steady burn of conversation that emanated from within. She beckoned him over. After they had foiled the Razak's counterattack,
the prominent members of Carvajal had sequestered themselves in an attempt to decide what action the village should take, and if Horst and his allies should be punished for initiating the hostilities. The group had been in deliberation most of the morning. Roran peeked into the room. Seated around the long table were Birgit, Loring, Sloane, Gedrick, Delwyn, Fisk, Morn, and a number of others. Horst presided at the head of the table.
"And I say that it was stupid and reckless," exclaimed Kizzelt, propping himself upright on his bony elbows. "You had no cause to endanger—"
Morn waved a hand.
"We've been over this before. Whether what has been done should have been done is beside the point. I happen to agree with it. Quimby was my friend as much as anyone's, and I shudder to think what those monsters would do with Roran. But what I want to know is how we can escape this predicament." "Easy, kill the soldiers," barked Sloane. "And then what? More men will follow until we drown in a sea of crimson tunics. Even if we surrender Roran, it'll do no good. You heard what the Razak said. They'll kill us if we protect Roran and enslave us if we don't. You may feel differently, but as for myself, I would rather die than spend my life as a slave."
Morn shook his head, his mouth set in a flat, grim line.
"We cannot survive."
Fisk leaned forward.
"We could leave."
"There's nowhere to go," retorted Kizzelt. "We're backed against the spine. The soldiers have blocked the road, and beyond them is the rest of the Empire."
"It's all your fault," cried Thane, stabbing a shaking finger at Horst. "They will torch our houses and murder our children because of you. You!"
Horst stood so quickly his chair toppled over backward.
"Where is your honour, man? Will you let them eat us without fighting back?"
"Yes, if it means suicide otherwise."
Thane glared around the table, then stormed out past Roran. His face was contorted by pure, unadulterated fear. Gedrick spotted Roran then and waved him in.
"Come, come, we've been waiting for you."
Roran clasped his hands in the small of his back as scores of hard eyes inspected him.
"How can I help?"
"I think," said Gedrick, "we've all agreed that it would accomplish nothing to give you to the Empire at this point. Whether we would, if that wasn't the case, is neither here nor there. The only thing we can do is prepare for another attack. Horst will make spearheads and other weapons if he has time, and Fisk has agreed to construct shields. Fortunately, his carpentry shop didn't burn. And someone needs to oversee our defences. We would like it to be you. You'll have plenty of assistance."
Roran nodded.
"I'll do my best."
Beside Morn, Tara stood, towering over her husband. She was a large woman with grey-streaked black hair and strong hands that were just as capable of twisting off a chicken's head as separating a pair of brawlers. She said,
"Make sure you do, Roran, else we'll have more funerals."
Then she turned to Horst.
"Before we go any further, there are men to bury, and there are children who should be sent to safety, maybe to Corley's farm on Nost Creek.
You should go as well, Elaine."
"I won't leave Horst," said Elaine calmly.
Tara bristled.
"This is no place for a woman 5 months pregnant. You'll lose the child running around like you have."
"It would do me far more harm to worry in ignorance than remain here. I have borne my sons. I will stay, as I know you and every other wife in Carvajal will."
Horst came around the table and with a tender expression took Elaine's hand.
"Nor would I have you anywhere but at my side. The children should go, though. Corley will care for them well, but we must make sure that the route to his farm is clear."
"Not only that," rasped Loring, "none of us, not one blasted man Jack, can have a thing to do with the families down the valley, aside from Corley, of course. They can't help us, and we don't want those desecrators to trouble them."
Everyone agreed that he was right. Then the meeting ended, and the attendees dispersed throughout Carvajal. Before long, however, they recongregated, along with most of the village, in the small cemetery behind Gertrude's house. 10 white-swathed corpses were arranged beside their graves, a sprig of hemlock on each of their cold chests, and a silver amulet around each of their necks. Gertrude stood forth and recited the men's names.
Pa, Wyglif, Ged, Bardrick, Farold, Hale, Garner, Kelby, Melkoff, and Album.
She placed black pebbles over their eyes, then raised her arms, lifted her face to the sky, and began the quavering death lay. Tears seeped from the corners of her closed eyes as her voice rose and fell with the immemorial phrases, sighing and moaning with the village's sorrow. She sang of the earth and the night and of humanity's ageless sorrow from which none escape. After the last mournful note faded into silence, family members praised the feats and traits of those they had lost. Then the bodies were buried. As Roran listened, his gaze lit upon the anonymous mound where the three soldiers had been interred.
One killed by Nolfavrel and two by me.
He could still feel the visceral shock of muscle and bone giving, crunching, pulping under his hammer. His bile rose and he had to struggle not to be sick in full view of the village.
I am the one who destroyed them.
Roran had never expected or wanted to kill, and yet he had taken more lives than anyone else in Carvajal. It felt as if his brow was marked with blood. He left as soon as possible, not even stopping to speak with Katrina, and climbed to a point where he could survey Carvajal and consider how best to protect it. Unfortunately, the houses were too far apart to form a defensive perimeter by just fortifying the spaces between buildings, nor did Roran think it would be a good idea to have soldiers fighting up against the walls of people's houses and trampling their gardens.
The Anora River guards our western flank, he thought. But as for the rest of Carvajal, we couldn't even keep a child out of it. What can we build in a few hours that will be a strong enough barrier?
He jogged into the middle of the village and shouted, I need everyone who is free to help cut down trees. After a minute, men began to trickle out of the houses and through the streets. Come on, more! We all have to help! Roran waited as the group around him continued to grow. One of Loring's sons, Darman, shouldered to his side.
What's your plan?
Roran raised his voice so they could all hear.
We need a wall around Carvajal. The thicker, the better. I figure if we get some big trees, lay them on their sides, and sharpen the branches, the Razak will have a pretty hard time getting over them.
How many trees do you think it'll take?
Asked Orval. Roran hesitated, trying to gauge Carvajal's circumference.
At least 50, maybe 60 to do it properly.
The men swore and began to argue.
Wait!
Roran counted the number of people in the crowd. He arrived at 48.
If you each fell a tree in the next hour, we'll be almost done. Can you do that?
What do you take us for? Retorted Orval.
The last time I took an hour on a tree, I was 10.
Darman spoke up.
What about brambles? We could drape them over the trees. I don't know anyone who can climb through a knot of thorny vines.
Roran grinned.
That's a great idea. Also, those of you with sons, have them harness your horses so we can drag the trees back.
The men agreed and scattered through Carvajal to gather axes and saws for the job. Roran stopped Darman and said,
Make sure that the trees have branches all along the trunk, or else they won't work.
Where will you be?
Asked Darman.
Working on another line of defence.
Roran left him then and ran to Quimby's house, where he found Birgit busy boarding up the windows.
Yes, she said, looking at him.
He quickly explained his plan with the trees.
I want to dig a trench inside the ring of trees to slow down anyone who gets through. We could even put pointed stakes in the bottom of it and...
What's your point, Roran?
I'd like you to organise every woman, child and everyone else you can to dig. It's too much for me to handle by myself, and we don't have long.
Roran looked her straight in the eyes.
Please.
Birgit frowned.
Why ask me?
Because, like me, you hate the Razak, and I know you will do everything possible to stop them.
Aye,
whispered Birgit, then clapped her hands briskly.
Very well, as you wish. But I will never forget, Roran Garrowson, that it was you and your family who brought about my husband's doom.
She strode away before Roran could respond. He accepted her animosity with equanimity. It was to be expected, considering her loss.
He was only lucky she had not started a blood feud.
Then he shook himself and ran to where the main road entered Carvajal. It was the weakest spot in the village and had to be doubly protected. The Razak can't be allowed to just blast their way in again. Roran recruited Baldur, and together they began excavating a ditch across the road. "I'll have to go soon," warned Baldur between strokes of his pickaxe.
"Dad needs me in the forge."
Roran grunted an acknowledgement without looking up. As he worked, his mind once again filled with memories of the soldiers, how they had looked as he struck them, and the feeling, the horrible feeling of smashing a body as if it were a rotten stump. He paused, nauseated, and noted the commotion throughout Carvajal as people readied themselves for the next assault. After Baldur left, Roran completed the thigh-deep ditch himself, then went to Fisk's workshop. With the carpenter's permission, he had 5 logs from the stockpile of seasoned wood pulled by horses back to the main road. There Roran tipped the logs on end into the trench so that they formed an impenetrable barrier into Carvajal. As he tamped down the earth around the logs, Darman trotted up.
"We got the trees. They're just being put into place now."
Roran accompanied him to Carvajal's northern edge, where 12 men wrestled 4 lush green pines into alignment, while a team of draft horses under the whip of a young boy returned to the foothills.
"Most of us are helping to retrieve the trees. The others got inspired. They seemed determined to chop down the rest of the forest when I left."
"Good. We can use the extra timber."
Darman pointed to a pile of dense brambles that sat on the edge of Kizzelt's fields.
"I cut those along the Anora. Use them however you want. I'm going to find more."
Roran clapped him on the arm, then turned toward the eastern side of Carvajal, where a long, curved line of women, children and men laboured in the dirt. He went to them and found Birgit issuing orders like a general and distributing water among the diggers. The trench was already 5 feet wide and 2 feet deep. When Birgit paused for breath, he said,
"I'm impressed."
She brushed back a lock of hair without looking at him. "We ploughed the ground to begin with. It made things easier."
"Do you have a shovel I can use?" he asked.
Birgit pointed to a mound of tools at the other end of the trench. As Roran walked toward it, he spied the copper gleam of Katrina's hair in the midst of the bobbing backs. Beside her, Sloane hacked at the soft loam with a furious, obsessive energy, as if he were attempting to tear open the earth's skin, to peel back its clay hide and expose the muscle beneath. His eyes were wild and his teeth were bared in a knotted grimace, despite the flecks of dirt and filth that spotted his lips. Roran shuddered at Sloane's expression and hurried past, averting his face so as to avoid meeting his bloodshot gaze. He grabbed a shovel and immediately plunged it into the soil, doing his best to forget his worries in the heat of physical exertion. The day progressed in a continuous rush of activity, without breaks for meals or rest. The trench grew longer and deeper until it cupped 2/3 of the village and reached the banks of the Anora River. All the loose dirt was piled on the inside edge of the trench in an attempt to prevent anyone from jumping over it and to make it difficult to climb out. The wall of trees was finished in early afternoon. Roran stopped digging then to help sharpen the innumerable branches, which were overlapped and interlocked as much as possible, and affix the nets of brambles. Occasionally they had to pull out a tree so farmers like Ivor could drive their livestock into the safety of Carvajal. By evening the fortifications were stronger and more extensive than Roran had dared hope, though they still required several more hours of work to complete to his satisfaction. He sat on the ground, gnawing a hunk of sourdough bread and staring at the stars through a haze of exhaustion. A hand dropped on his shoulder, and he looked up to see Olbreich. "Here." Olbreich extended a rough shield, made of sword boards pegged together, and a 6-foot-long spear. Roran accepted them gratefully. Then Olbreich proceeded onward, distributing spears and shields to whomever he encountered. Roran dragged himself upright, got his hammer from Horst's house, and thus armed, went to the entrance to the main road, where Baldur and 2 others kept watch. "Wake me when you need to rest," Roran said, then lay on the soft grass underneath the eaves of a nearby house.
He arranged his weapons so he could find them in the dark, and closed his eyes in eager anticipation.
Roran!
The whisper came from by his right ear.
Katrina?
He struggled into a sitting position, blinking as she unshuttered a lantern so a key of light struck his thigh.
What are you doing here? I wanted to see you.
Her eyes, large and mysterious against her pale face, pooled with the night shadow. She took his arm and led him to a deserted porch far out of earshot of Baldur and the other guards. There she placed her hands on his cheeks and softly kissed him, but he was too tired and troubled to respond to her affection. She drew away and studied him.
What is wrong, Roran?
A bark of humorless laughter escaped him.
What's wrong?
The world is wrong. It's as askew as a picture frame knocked on its side. He jammed his fist against his gut.
And I am wrong. Every time I allow myself to relax, I see the soldiers bleeding under my hammer. Men I killed, Katrina. And their eyes. They knew they were about to die and that they could do nothing about it.
He trembled in the darkness.
They knew, I knew, and I still had to do it. It couldn't...
Words failed him as he felt hot tears roll down his cheeks. Katrina cradled his head as Roran cried from the shock of the past few days. He wept for Garrow and Aragorn. He wept for Parr, Quimby and the other dead. He wept for himself, and he wept for the fate of Carvajal. He sobbed until his emotions ebbed and left him as dry and hollow as an old barley husk. Forcing himself to take a long breath, Roran looked at Katrina and noticed her own tears. He brushed them away with his thumb like diamonds in the night.
Katrina, my love.
He said it again, tasting the words.
My love, I have naught to give you but my love. Still, I must ask, will you marry me?
In the dim lantern light, he saw pure joy and wonder leap across her face. Then she hesitated, and troubled doubt appeared. It was wrong for him to ask or for her to accept without Sloane's permission. But Roran no longer cared. He had to know now if he and Katrina would spend their lives together. Then, softly,
yes, Roran, I will.
Under a darkling sky. That night it rained. Layer upon layer of pregnant clouds blanketed Palancar Valley, clinging to the mountains with tenacious arms and filling the air with heavy, cold mist. From inside, Roran watched as cords of grey water pelted the trees with their frothing leaves, muddied the trench around Carvajal, and scrabbled with blunt fingers against the thatch roofs and eaves as the clouds disgorged their load. Everything was streaked, blurred and hidden behind the torrent's inexorable streamers. By mid-morning the storm had abated, although a continuous drizzle still percolated through the mist. It quickly soaked Roran's hair and clothes when he took his watch at the barricade to the main road. He squatted by the upright logs, shook his cloak, then pulled the hood farther over his face and tried to ignore the cold. Despite the weather, Roran soared and exulted with his joy at Katrina's acceptance. They were engaged! In his mind, it was as if a missing piece of the world had dropped into place, as if he had been granted the confidence of an invulnerable warrior. What did the soldiers matter, or the Razak, or the Empire itself, before love such as theirs? They were nothing but tinder to the blaze. For all his new bliss, however, his mind was entirely focused on what had become the most important conundrum of his existence. How to assure that Katrina would survive Galbatorix's wrath. He had thought of nothing else since waking. The best thing would be for Katrina to go to Corley's, he decided, staring down the hazy road. But she would never agree to leave, unless Sloane told her to. I might be able to convince him. I'm sure he wants her out of danger as much as I do. As he considered ways to approach the butcher, the clouds thickened again, and the rain renewed its assault on the village, arching down in stinging waves. Around Roran, the puddles jumped to life as pellets of water drummed their surfaces, bouncing back up like startled grasshoppers.
When Roran grew hungry, he passed his watch to Larn, Loring's youngest son, and went to find lunch, darting from the shelter of one eave to another. As he rounded a corner, he was surprised to see Ulbreich on the house's porch, arguing violently with a group of men. Ridley shouted, "You're blind! Follow the cottonwoods and they'll never see! You took the Addlebrains route!"
"Try it if you want," retorted Ulbreich.
"I will.
Then you can tell me how you like the taste of arrows."
"Maybe," said Thane, "we aren't as club-footed as you are."
Ulbreich turned on him with a snarl.
"Your words are as thick as your wits. I'm not stupid enough to risk my family on the cover of a few leaves that I've never seen before."
Thane's eyes bulged and his face turned a deep, mottled crimson.
"What?" taunted Ulbreich. "Have you no tongue?"
Thane roared and struck Ulbreich on the cheek with his fist. Ulbreich laughed.
"Your arm is as weak as a woman's."
Then he grabbed Thane's shoulder and threw him off the porch and into the mud, where he lay on his side, stunned. Holding his spear like a staff, Roran jumped beside Ulbreich, preventing Ridley and the others from laying hands on him.
"No more," growled Roran, furious. "We have other enemies. An assembly can be called. An arbitrators will decide whether compensation is due to either Ulbreich or Thane. But until then, we can't fight ourselves."
"Easy for you to say," spat Ridley. "You have no wife or children."
Then he helped Thane to his feet and departed with the group of men. Roran stared hard at Ulbreich and the purple bruise that was spreading beneath his right eye.
"What started it?" he asked.
Ulbreich
stopped with a grimace and felt his jaw.
"I went scouting with Darman. The Razak have posted soldiers on several hills. They can see across the Anora and up and down the valley. One or two of us might be able to creep past them without notice, but we'll never get the children to Corley without killing the soldiers. And then we might as well tell the Razak where we're going."
Dread clutched at Roran, flooding like poison through his heart and veins.
"What can I do?"
Sick with a sense of impending doom, he put an arm around Albrecht's shoulders.
"Come on, Gertrude should have a look at you."
"No,"
said Ulbreich, shrugging him off. "She has more pressing cases than me." He took a preparatory breath as if he were about to dive into a lake and lumbered off through the downpour in the direction of the forge. Roran watched him go, then shook his head and went inside. He found Elaine sitting on the floor with a row of children, sharpening a pile of spearheads with files and whetstones. Roran gestured to Elaine. Once they were in another room, he told her what had just occurred. Elaine swore harshly, startling him, for he had never heard her use such language, then asked, "Is there cause for Thane to declare a feud?"
"Possibly," admitted Roran. "They both insulted each other, but Albrecht's oaths were the strongest. However, Thane did strike first. You could declare a feud yourself."
"Nonsense," asserted Elaine, wrapping a shawl around her shoulders. "This is a dispute for arbitrators to resolve. If we must pay a fine, so be it, as long as bloodshed is avoided." She headed out the front door, a finished spear in hand. Troubled, Roran located bread and meat in the kitchen, then helped the children sharpen spearheads. Once Felda, one of the mothers, arrived, Roran left the children in her care and slogged back through Carverhull to the main road. As he squatted in the mud, a shaft of sunlight burst underneath the clouds and illuminated the folds of rain, so each drop flashed with crystalline fire. Roran stared, awestruck, ignoring the water streaming down his face. The rift in the clouds widened until a shelf of massive thunderheads hung over the western three quarters of Palancar Valley, facing a strip of pure blue sky. Because of the billowy roof above and the angle of the sun, the rain-drenched landscape was lit brilliantly on one side and painted with rich shadows on the other, giving the fields, bushes, trees, river and mountains the most extraordinary colours. It was as if the entire world had been transformed into a sculpture of burnished metal. Just then, movement caught Roran's eye, and he looked down to see a soldier standing on the road, his mail shining like ice. The man gaped with amazement at Carverhall's new fortifications, then turned and fled back into the golden mist.
"Soldiers!"
shouted Roran, jolting to his feet. He wished that he had his bow, but he had left it inside to protect it from the elements. His only comfort was that the soldiers would have an even harder time keeping their weapons dry. Men and women ran from their houses, gathered along the trench and peered out through the wall of overlapping pines. The long branches wept beads of moisture, translucent cabochons that reflected the rows of anxious eyes. Roran found himself standing beside Sloane. The butcher held one of Fisk's makeshift shields in his left hand, and in his right a cleaver curved like a half-moon. His belt was festooned with at least a dozen knives, all of them large and honed to a razor edge. He and Roran exchanged brisk nods, then refocused on where the soldier had disappeared. Less than a minute later, the disembodied voice of a Razak slithered out of the mist.
"By continuing to defend Carvajal, you proclaim your choice and seal your doom. You shall die."
Loring responded,
"Show your maggot-riddled faces if you dare, you lily-livered, bandy-legged, snake-eyed wretches. We'll crack your skulls open and fatten our hogs on your blood."
A dark shape floated toward them, followed by the dull thump of a spear embedding itself in a door an inch from Gedrick's left arm.
"Take cover!"
shouted Horst from the middle of the line. Roran knelt behind his shield and peered through a hairline gap between two of the boards. He was just in time, for a half-dozen spears hurtled over the wall of trees and buried themselves among the cowering villagers. From somewhere in the mist came an agonized scream. Roran's heart jumped with a painful flutter. He panted for breath, though he had not moved, and his hands were slick with sweat. He heard the faint sound of shattering glass on the northern edge of Carvajal, then the bellow of an explosion and crashing timbers. Spinning around, he and Sloane sped through Carvajal, where they found a team of six soldiers dragging away the splintered remains of several trees. Beyond them, pale and wraith-like in the glittering shards of rain, sat the Razak on their black horses. Without slowing, Roran fell upon the first man, jabbing his spear. His first and second stabs were deflected by an upraised arm, then Roran caught the soldier on the hip, and when he stumbled, in his throat. Sloane howled like an enraged beast, threw his cleaver and split one of the men's helms, crushing his skull. Two soldiers charged him with drawn swords. Sloane sidestepped, laughing now, and blocked their attacks with his shield. One soldier swung so hard his blade stuck in the shield's rim. Sloane yanked him closer and gored him through the eye with a carving knife from his belt. Drawing a second cleaver, the butcher circled his other opponent with a maniacal grin.
"Shall I gut and hamstring you?" he demanded, almost prancing with a terrible bloody glee.
Roran lost his spear to the next two men he faced. He barely managed to drag out his hammer in time to stop a sword from shearing off his leg. The soldier who had torn the spear from Roran's grip now cast the weapon at him, aiming for his breast. Roran dropped his hammer, caught the shaft in mid-air, which astounded him as much as the soldiers, spun it around and drove the spear through the armour and ribs of the man who had launched it. Left weaponless, Roran was forced to retreat before the remaining soldier. He stumbled over a corpse, cutting his calf on a sword as he fell, and rolled to avoid a two-handed blow from the soldier, scrabbling frantically in the ankle-deep mud for something, anything he could use for a weapon. A hilt bruised his fingers, and he ripped it from the muck and slashed at the soldier's sword hand, severing his thumb. The man stared dumbly at the glistening stump, then said,
"This is what comes from not shielding myself."
"Aye," agreed Roran, and beheaded him. The last soldier panicked and fled toward the impassive spectres of the Razak, while Sloane bombarded him with a stream of insults and foul names. When the soldier finally pierced the shining curtain of rain, Roran watched with a thrill of horror as the two black figures bent down from their steeds on either side of the man and gripped the nape of his neck with twisted hands. The cruel fingers tightened, and the man shrieked desperately and convulsed, then went limp. The Razak placed the corpse behind one of their saddles before turning their horses and riding away. Roran shuddered and looked at Sloane, who was cleaning his blades. "You fought well." He had never suspected that the butcher contained such ferocity.
Sloane said in a low voice, "They'll never get Katrina. Never, even if I must skin the lot of them, or fight 1,000 Urgals and the king to